7.2 blank 7.3 blank 7.4 Aunt Mildred saved him from the worst of it, pulling strings, asserting her authority as chairman of the English department, cutting through spool after spool of red tape, threatening to quit and protest if the director of admissions didn't bend to her will, arguing her case over 2-hour-long meetings with the newly installed anti-war president, Francis F. Kilcoyne, a man known for his compassion and high moral principles. Professor Adler wrangled a spot for Ferguson as a fully matriculating student at Brooklyn College 1 week before the first semester of his junior year began. When Ferguson asked her how she had managed to pull off such an incredible stunt, Mildred said, "I told them the truth, Archie." The truth being that he had come to the defense of a black friend under threat from a white bigot and had been exonerated for his actions in court, which would suggest that his Walt Whitman scholarship at Princeton had been revoked unfairly and he deserved a place at Brooklyn. Not only because his grade point average ranked him in the top 10% of his class, but because the loss of the scholarship would bar him from continuing at Princeton for lack of funds, and if he was not enrolled in another college by the beginning of the fall semester, he would lose his student deferment on top of losing his scholarship and find himself subject to the military draft. As an opponent of the war in Vietnam, he would refuse to join the army if called upon to serve, which likely would result in a prison term for resisting the selective service laws. And wasn't it Brooklyn College's duty to save this promising young man from such a dark and pointless outcome? It had never occurred to him that his aunt had it in her to take such a forceful stand about anything, least of all about him or anyone else in the family. But on August 21st, less than an hour after calling DeWitt's office and being told the great man was traveling abroad, he had turned to Aunt Mildred out of desperation. Not because he was expecting her to do anything for him, but because he needed advice. And with Nagel off on a Mediterranean island, sifting through pre-Hellenic pottery shards, she was the only one who could give it to him. Uncle Don picked up the phone that day on the fourth ring. Mildred was out doing some errands, he said, and wasn't expected back for another hour or so. But Ferguson couldn't wait an hour. His insides were jammed up with dread and disbelief as he continued to swallow down the words of DeWitt's letter. So he barfed out the whole thing to Don, who was shocked and outraged and sufficiently furious to tell Ferguson that DeWitt should be drawn and quartered for what he had done. But even in those early moments of the crisis, when Ferguson was still in no condition to think, Don was feeling his way toward a solution, wondering how to finagle an opening that would get Ferguson into another college before time ran out on them. Meaning it was his idea to begin with, but once Mildred returned to the apartment and talked to Don, it quickly became her idea as well. And when she called back Ferguson 45 minutes later, she told him not to worry because she was going to handle everything. It made all the difference to have her on his side. The hot and cold Aunt Mildred, the kind and cruel Aunt Mildred, the inconstant, not-so-friendly sister of her sister Rose, the somewhat encouraging but mostly distracted stepmother of Don's sons Noah, the good-willed but essentially unengaged aunt of her only nephew, now seemed to be telling her sister's son that she cared about him far more than he had ever suspected. She had told Ferguson how she had managed to get him into Brooklyn College, but when he asked her why she had bothered to go to all that trouble for him in the first place, the ferocity of her answer startled him. "I've tremendous faith in you, Archie. I believe in your future. And over my dead body was I going to allow anyone to take that future away from you? Let Gordon DeWitt go fry an egg. We're people of the book, and people of the book have to stick together. Queen Esther, Mother Courage, Mother Jones, Sister Kenny, Aunt Mildred." The first and most important thing to be said about going to Brooklyn College was that the tuition was free. In a rare display of political wisdom, The city fathers of New York had declared that the boys and girls of the five boroughs were entitled to an education at an annual cost of no dollars, which not only helped advance the principles of democracy and proved how the greater good might be served when municipal tax revenues were put into the correct hands, it offered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and over the years, millions of New York boys and girls the opportunity to receive an education most of them would not otherwise have been able to afford. And Ferguson, who could no longer afford the high cost of Princeton, thanked those long-dead city fathers every time he strode up the concrete steps of the Flatbush Avenue subway station and walked onto the Midwood campus. More than that, it was a good college, an excellent college. A minimum high school average of 87 was required for admission, along with passing a stringent entrance exam, which meant there was no one in any of his classes who had performed under a B-plus level. And with most of them in the 92 to 96 range, Ferguson was surrounded by highly intelligent people, many of them smart enough to qualify as brilliant. Princeton had had its share of brilliant students as well, but also a certain percentage of Deadwood legacy boys, whereas Brooklyn consisted of both boys and girls, thankfully, and carried no Deadwood. Everyone came from the city, of course, roughly twice the number of students as at Princeton, where the undergraduate population had come from every part of the country. But Ferguson was a die-hard New Yorker now and staunchly pro-city. And just as he had relished the companionship of his New York friends at Camp Paradise when he was a boy, he took pleasure in being with his high-strung, argumentative fellow New Yorkers at BC, where the student body might have been less geographically diverse than at Princeton, but was more humanly diverse in its teeming jumble of ethnicities and cultural backgrounds, with hordes of Catholics and Jews, a refreshing number of Black and Asian faces, and since most of them were the grandchildren of Ellis Island immigrants, the odds were better than even that they were the first ones in their families ever to attend college. On top of that, the campus was a model of sound architectural design, not at all what Ferguson had been expecting. A cozy 26 acres as compared to the 500 acres at Princeton, but just as attractive to his eyes, with elegant Georgian buildings filling the landscape instead of imposing Gothic towers. Grassy quadrangles studded with elms, and a lily pond and garden to visit in the lulls between classes, with no dormitories, no eating clubs, and no football madness. It was an altogether different way of going to college, with anti-war politics replacing sports as the principal obsession on campus, the demands of academic work pushing out most extracurricular pastimes, and best of all, the chance to go home to his apartment on East 89th Street when his work for the day was done. The subway rides from Yorkville in Manhattan to Midwood in Brooklyn and then back again every Monday through Thursday, were so long that Ferguson managed to do most of the reading for his courses while sitting on the train. He didn't register for Aunt Mildred's class on the Victorian novel because he thought his presence in the room might be a burden on her. But when Uncle Don came back as a guest lecturer in the spring to teach his biennial one-semester course on the art of biography, Ferguson signed up for it. Don delivered a dense, rapid-fire mini-lecture at the start of each class and then opened things up for general discussion. A somewhat awkward, scattershot kind of teacher, Ferguson supposed, but never dull or ponderous, always up to the challenge of thinking on his feet, both humorous and deadpan, as he was under most circumstances elsewhere. And what a range of books he had them read that spring. Plutarch, Suetonius, Augustine, Vasari, Montaigne, Rousseau, and Dr. Johnson's bizarre, sexed-up chum, James Boswell, who confessed in his journals that he would interrupt his writing in mid-sentence and go into the London streets and make rumpty-rumpty with as many as three different whores in a single night. But the most enthralling part of that class for Ferguson was finally reading Montaigne for the first time. And now that he had been exposed to the Frenchman's intractable lightning-bolt sentences, he had found a new master to accompany him on his own travels through the land of ink. So it was that a bad thing had been transformed into a good thing. A knockout punch from Gordon DeWitt that theoretically should have flattened him. But just as Ferguson was beginning to fall, a dozen people jumped into the ring and caught him in their arms before his body hit the canvas. Aunt Mildred, first and most significantly as the strongest of the body catchers, but also quick-thinking Uncle Don, and one by one all the others who gathered around him when they were told about the punch. Celia, his mother and Dan, Noah, Jim and Nancy, Billy and Joanna, Ron and Peg, and Howard, who talked to Nagel the morning after Ferguson's ex-academic advisor returned to Princeton, and then Nagel himself, who wrote an uncommonly warm letter after Howard broke the disturbing news to him about the scholarship, offering to help in any way he could and suggesting that perhaps Susan could swing something for him at Rutgers. How much that letter meant to Ferguson, Nagel reaching out to him as a friend and taking his side over DeWitt's, and the long telephone conversation with Amy and Luther in Montreal, coupled with the alarming turn that led to Howard's breakup with Mona Veltri, a fierce verbal spat about which one of them had been responsible for leading the group to Tom's Bar and Grill, each one blaming the other until they lost control of themselves and their big love died as rapidly as a sick flower dies with the first frost. And then, no more than days after that, Luther abruptly put an end to it with Amy, pushing her out the door and demanding that she go back to America. And there was Ferguson's dazed and grieving stepsister, telling him that Luther had done it for, quote, her own good. "And please, Archie," she said, "my dear, crazy brother, don't do anything stupid like running off to Canada. Just hold your ground and hold your breath and pray that something good turns up," which was precisely what happened because of Mother Courage Mildred. And despite the havoc he lived through in those days of uncertainty, Ferguson felt so deeply loved by the people he loved that winning the Walt Whitman Scholarship turned out to have done less for his morale than losing it. The world was churning. All things everywhere were in flux. The war was boiling in his blood. Newark was a dead city on the other side of the river. Lovers were going up in flames, and now that Ferguson had been granted his reprieve, he was back inside his book about Dr. Noyes and the dead children of R. 2 hours starting at 6 o'clock every morning from Monday to Thursday, and then as many hours as possible from Friday to Sunday, in spite of the ever-mounting load of schoolwork, which he had to plow through diligently in order to repay his debt to Mildred, who would have been disappointed in him if he slacked off and failed to do well. Montaigne, Leibniz, Leopardi, and Dr. Noyes. The world was falling apart, and the only way not to fall apart with it was to keep his mind fixed on his work. To roll out of bed every morning and get down to business, whether the sun chose to come up that day or not. The free tuition was a blessing, but there were still a number of money problems to be dealt with, and for the first weeks of the fall semester, Ferguson struggled to come up with a plan that would not include help from his mother and stepfather. The scholarship had covered room and board as well as tuition, which had allowed him to stuff his face at no charge 3 times a day, 5 days a week, 5 days that could have been 7 days if he hadn't insisted on spending the other 2 days in New York. But now that he was in the city, and only in the city, he had to pay for all his meals and groceries, which was something he could no longer afford to do. Not after shelling out $5,000 to the Brattleboro lawyer and being left with just over $2,000 in the bank. He figured he could muddle along on about $4,000 a year, which would provide him with enough crumbs to sustain a lowly sort of church mouse existence. But $2,000 wasn't $4,000. And he still had only half of what he would need. True to form, Dan offered to make up the difference with a monthly allowance, which Ferguson reluctantly agreed to because he had no choice in the end, knowing the only alternative was to take a part-time job somewhere, assuming he could find one, which would make it impossible to go on with his book. He said yes because he had to say yes, but just because he was thankful to Dan for the $200 a month, that didn't require him to feel happy about the arrangement. In early November, help came from an unexpected source, which directly or indirectly could be traced back to his own past, but at the same time had nothing to do with him. Others were responsible for giving him the money he needed, money he hadn't earned but had nevertheless worked for, without any intention of earning money. For just as a writer couldn't know whether he was about to be mauled or embraced, he couldn't know whether the hours he spent at his desk would lead to something or nothing. All along, Ferguson had assumed nothing, and therefore he had never spoken the words writing and money in the same breath, thinking only sellouts and Grub Street hacks dreamed about money while doing their work, thinking money would always have to come from somewhere else in order to feed his compulsion for filling up white rectangles with row after row of descending black marks. But at the preposterously unadvanced age of 20, Ferguson learned that always did not mean always, but just most of the time, and at those rare times when the somber expectations of always were proved to be wrong, the only proper response was to thank the gods for their random act of benevolence and then return to the somber expectations of always, even if one's first encounter with the principle of most of the time thundered in the bones with the force of a holy benediction. Tumult Books, the legitimate non-mimeo press that had been launched by Ron, Lewis, and Anne in the spring, released its first batch of publications on November 4th. Two collections of poems, one by Lewis, the other by Anne, Ron's translations of Pierre Reverdy, and Billy's 372-page epic, Crushed Heads. The angel of the Enterprise, Anne's mother's first husband's ex-wife, an effusive woman in her mid-40s named Trixie Davenport, threw a large party at her Lexington Avenue duplex to celebrate the event. And Ferguson, along with nearly everyone else he knew, was invited to the Saturday night bash. He had never felt comfortable in crowds. The crush of too many bodies crammed together in enclosed spaces tended to make him dizzy and mute. But that night was different for some reason, perhaps because he felt so good for Billy after all the years he had put into writing his book, or perhaps because he found it amusing to see the scruffy, impoverished downtown poets and painters mixing with the East Side swells. But whether it was for one of those reasons or both of them, he felt glad to be there that night, standing next to the beautiful, somewhat intimidated Celia, who wasn't much of a crowd person herself. And as Ferguson turned around and surveyed that packed and noisy scene, he saw John Ashbery alone in a corner, puffing on a gitane, Alex Katz sipping a glass of white wine, Harry Matthews shaking the hand of a tall, red-headed woman in a blue dress, Norman Bloom laughing as he put someone in a pretend hammerlock, and there was dapper, frizzy-haired Noah, standing with a voluptuous, frizzy-haired Vicky Tremaine, and there was Howard talking to none other than Amy Schneiderman, who had come down to New York for the weekend, and 10 minutes after Ferguson arrived, there was Ron Pearson, elbowing his way toward him, and a moment later Ron was putting his arm around his shoulder and guiding him out of the room because he wanted to talk to him about something. They made their way upstairs, walked down a corridor, turned left down another corridor, and slipped into an empty room with a couple of thousand books in it and 6 or 7 paintings hanging on one of the walls. Something turned out to be a business proposition. If a minute, bound-to-be-unprofitable operation such as Tumult Books could be called a business. As Ron explained it, the triumvirate in charge of running the press had voted to include Ferguson on next year's list by gathering together his 3 gizmo titles and publishing them as a single book. According to their calculations, it would come out to around 250 or 275 pages, and they could have it ready sometime in the next 8 to 12 months. What did he say to that? I don't know, Ferguson said. Do you think those books are good enough? We wouldn't be making the offer if we thought they were bad, Ron said. Of course they're good enough. And what about Billy? Doesn't he have to give his permission? He already has. Billy's all in behind it. He's with us now, and he wants you to be with us, too. What a guy. I grapple with my groots and shoot down the grovelers and medicine men with my trusted blunderbuss. No one has ever written a cooler sentence than that. I should also mention the money. What money? We're trying to act like real publishers, Archie. I don't understand. A contract, an advance, royalties, surely you've heard of those things. Vaguely, in some other world where I don't happen to live. 3 books in 1 book, published in an edition of 3,000 copies, we thought a $2,000 advance would have a nice asymmetrical ring to it. Don't joke, Ron, $2,000 would save me. No more begging on street corners, no more handouts from people who can't afford to hand out money, no more midnight sweats. Please tell me you're not pulling my leg. Ron smiled one of his thin, minimal smiles and sat down in a chair. The standard procedure is to get half when you sign the contract, he continued, and the other half when the book is published. But if you need the full amount up front, I'm sure that can be arranged. How can you be sure? Because, Ron said, pointing to a Mondrian on the opposite wall, Trixie can do anything she wants. Yes, Ferguson replied as he turned around and looked at the canvas. I suppose she can. There's just one last thing to discuss. A title, an overall title for the 3 books. There's no rush, but Anne came up with one at the meeting that we all thought was pretty funny. Funny because you're still so shockingly young and new to the world that we sometimes ask ourselves if you still wear diapers. Only at night, but I don't need them during the day anymore. Mr. Sloppy Pants walks around in clean undies now. Most of the time, in any case. And what did Anne suggest? Collected works. Ah, yes, it's pretty funny, all right, but also, what's the word I'm looking for? A bit funereal. As if I'd been embalmed and was about to set off on a one-way trip to the past tense. I think I'd prefer something a little more hopeful. It's your book. You're the one who gets to decide. How about prolusions? As in those early works by Milton? That's right, a literary composition of a preliminary or preparatory nature. We know what the word means, but will anyone else know? If they don't, they can look it up. Ron removed his glasses, rubbed down the lenses with a handkerchief, and then put them back on. After a small pause, he shrugged and said, I'm with you, Archie. Let them look it up. Ferguson walked back into the party feeling stunned and weightless, as if his head were no longer attached to his body. When he tried to tell Celia the good news, the din of voices circling around them was so intense that she couldn't hear what he was saying to her. Never mind, Ferguson said, as he squeezed her hand and kissed her on the neck. I'll tell you later. Then he looked out at the throng of vertical people gathered in the room and saw that Howard and Amy were still talking to each other, standing quite close now, each one leaning into the other and entirely absorbed in their conversation. And as he watched how his stepsister and former roommate were looking at each other, it dawned on Ferguson that they could be turning into an item, that with Mona and Luther both gone, and no doubt forever gone for both of them, it made sense for Howard and Amy to be exploring the possibilities, and how curious it would be if Howard wound up inserting himself into the tangled, mixed-up tribe of overlapping clans and lineages to become an honorary member of the Schneiderman Adler Ferguson Marks traveling vaudeville team, which would turn his friend into an unofficial brother-in-law. And what an honor that would be, Ferguson said to himself, welcoming Howard into the inner circle and giving him advice on how to duck when Amy started throwing NECA waivers at his head. The extraordinary Amy Schneiderman, the girl he had wanted so badly that it still hurt to think about what might have happened, but never did. He had enough money to live on for a year, and for the first 5 months of that year, Ferguson managed to hold himself together by sticking to his plan. Only 4 things mattered to him now. Writing his book, loving Celia, loving his friends, and going back and forth to Brooklyn College. It wasn't that he had stopped paying attention to the world, but the world was no longer simply falling apart. The world had caught fire. And the question was, what to do or not to do when the world was on fire and you didn't have the equipment to put out the flames? When the fire was in you as much as it was around you, and no matter what you did or didn't do, your actions would change nothing. Stick to the plan by writing the book. That was the only answer Ferguson could come up with. Write the book by replacing the real fire with an imaginary fire and hope the effort would add up to something more than nothing. As for the Tet Offensive in South Vietnam, as for Lyndon Johnson's abdication, as for the murder of Martin Luther King, watch them as carefully as he could, take them in as deeply as he could, but other than that, nothing. He wasn't going to fight on the barricades, but he would cheer for the ones who did, and then he would return to his room and write his book. He understood how shaky that position was, the arrogance of it, the selfishness of it, the art above all else flaw in his thinking. But if he didn't hold fast to his argument, which probably wasn't an argument so much as an instinctive reflex, he would be giving in to a counter-argument that posited a world in which books were no longer necessary. And what moment could be more important for the writing of books than a year when the world was on fire, and you were on fire with it? Then came the first of the two big blows that crashed down on him that spring. At 9 o'clock in the evening on April 6th, 2 days after the murder of Martin Luther King, as real fires were burning in half the cities in America, the telephone rang in Ferguson's apartment on East 89th Street. Someone named Alan Blumenthal wanted to talk to Archie Ferguson. And was that Archie Ferguson on the line now? Yes, Ferguson said, trying to remember where he had heard the name Alan Blumenthal, which seemed to set off a distant bell in some far corner of his memory. Blumenthal, Blumenthal, and then the jolt of recognition arrived at last. Alan Blumenthal, the son of Ethel Blumenthal, the woman his father had been married to for the past 3 years, Ferguson's unknown stepbrother, 16 at the time of the wedding, and therefore 19 now, 2 years younger than Ferguson, Celia's age. You know who I am, don't you? Blumenthal asked. If you're the Alan Blumenthal I think you are, Ferguson said, then you're my stepbrother. A pause to let the magnitude of the word sink in. Hello, stepbrother. Blumenthal didn't laugh at Ferguson's mild but friendly joke, nor did he waste any time in getting down to business. At 7 o'clock that morning, while playing a round of pre-work tennis on an indoor court at the South Mountain Tennis Center with his boyhood friend Sam Brownstein, Ferguson's father had collapsed and died of a heart attack. The funeral would be held the day after tomorrow at Temple B'nai Abraham in Newark, and Blumenthal was calling on his mother's behalf to invite Ferguson to attend the service, which would be officiated by Rabbi Prince, and then to accompany the family to the cemetery in Woodbridge for the burial, after which, if Ferguson was so inclined, he could join them at the house in Maplewood. What should Blumenthal tell his mother? Yes or no? Yes, Ferguson said. Of course I'll be there. Stanley was such a wonderful guy, the unknown stepbrother said, as his voice began to wobble into another register. I can't believe this has happened. Ferguson heard the air catch in Blumenthal's throat, and suddenly the boy was sobbing. There were no tears for Ferguson, however. For a long time after he hung up the phone, he couldn't feel anything but an immense weight bearing down on his head, a 10-ton stone immobilizing him all the way down to his ankles and the soles of his feet. And then bit by bit, the weight turned inward and was supplanted by horror. Horror crawling up through his body and humming in his veins, and after the horror, an invasion of darkness. Darkness within him and around him, and a voice in his head telling him the world was no longer real. 54. And not one glimpse of him since that grotesque TV commercial 18 months ago. Prices never lower, spirits never higher. Imagine, dropping dead at 54. Not once in all the years of their struggles and silences had Ferguson ever wished for such a thing or imagined it could happen. His non-smoking, non-drinking, eternally fit and athletic father was going to live to an advanced old age, and somehow or other, at some point in the decades still to come, he and Ferguson would have found a way to purge the rancor that had grown between them. But that assumption had been based on the certainty that there were many more years ahead of them. And now there were no more years. There was not even a day, or an hour, for the smallest fraction of a second. 3 years of unbroken silence. That was the worst part of it now, those 3 years, and no chance to undo the silence anymore. No deathbed farewells, no premonitory illness to prepare him for the blow. And how strange it was that, ever since he had signed the contract for his book, Ferguson had been thinking more and more about his father again, because of the money, he suspected. Proof that there were people in the world willing to give him money for the no-account work of writing make-believe stories. And in the past month or so, Ferguson had even been considering the possibility of sending his father a copy of Prelusions when the book was published, in order to show him that he was getting by, getting along on his own terms, and also, perhaps, as an opening round gesture that might have led to some future reconciliation. Wondering if his father would respond or not, wondering if he would toss out the book or sit down and write him a letter. And if he did respond, then writing back to him and arranging to meet somewhere to have it out once and for all, honest and open with each other for the first time, no doubt cursing and shouting each other throughout most of it. And whenever Ferguson played out that scene in his head, it generally wound up in a bloody fistfight, with the two of them pounding each other until they were too tired to hold up their arms anymore. It was also possible that he might not have sent the book in the end, but at least he had been thinking about it, and surely that meant something. Surely that was a sign of hope, for even punches would have been better than the blank standoff of the past 3 years. Going to the synagogue, going to the cemetery, going to the house in Maplewood, the nullity and futility of it all. Meeting Ethel and her children for the first time, and the discovery that they were real people, with arms and legs and faces and hands. The distraught widow doing what she could to hold herself upright through the ordeal. Not the cold person of the wedding photograph in the Star Ledger, but a thoughtful, unpretentious woman who had fallen for his father and married him. Almost certainly a patient, giving wife, perhaps in some ways a better wife for his father than the fast-moving, independent Rose had been. And after receiving a kiss on the cheek from their mother, shaking hands with Alan and Stephanie, who clearly had loved Stanley more than Stanley's biological son ever had. Alan finishing his first year at Rutgers and intending to major in economics, which must have pleased his father. A sensible boy with his head in the real world, unlike the disappointing real son who mostly dwelled on the moon. And beyond his father's second family, Ferguson found himself with members of his first family as well. The aunts and uncles from California, Joan and Millie, Arnold and Lou, not seen since the early days of Ferguson's childhood. And what struck him most about those long-lost relatives was the curious fact that while the brothers did not look terribly alike, each in his different way bore a strong resemblance to his father. For some reason, Ferguson stayed on in the house longer than he should have. The old Castle of Silence, where he had been held prisoner for 7 years and had written the story about the shoes. For the most part, standing alone in a corner of the living room and not saying much to the several dozen strangers who were there, neither wanting to be there himself nor willing to leave, accepting condolences from various men and women after they were informed that he was Stanley's son. Nodding thanks, shaking hands, but still too stunned to do anything more than agree with them about how shocked and stunned they were by his father's sudden, shocking death. His aunts and uncles made an early exit. The weeping, overwrought Sam Brownstein and his wife, Peggy, headed for the door. But even after most of the other guests filed out toward the end of the afternoon, Ferguson still wasn't ready to call Dan and ask to be picked up. He was planning to spend the night at the house on Woodhall Crescent, because the reason why he had stayed so long, he now understood, was to have a chance to talk to Ethel in private. And when she walked up to him a couple of minutes later and asked if they could go off somewhere together to talk alone, he was comforted to know that she had been thinking the same thought as well. It was a sad conversation, one of the saddest conversations in the history of his life so far. Sitting with his unknown stepmother in the TV nook of the newly refurbished basement as they shared what they knew about the enigma that had been Stanley Ferguson. A man, Ethel admitted, had been all but unreachable to her. and how sorry Ferguson felt for that woman as he watched her convulse in tears, then pull herself together for a while, then collapse again. The shock of it, she kept saying, the shock of a 54-year-old man running at full speed into a brick wall of death. The second husband she had buried in the past 9 years. Ethel Blumberg, Ethel Blumenthal, Ethel Ferguson. For 2 decades, a sixth-grade teacher in the Livingston Public Schools. Mother of Alan and Stephanie. And yes, she said, it made perfect sense that they had adored Stanley because Stanley had been exceedingly good to them. For after much study on the subject of Stanley Ferguson, she had come to the conclusion that he was generous and kind to strangers, but closed off and impenetrable with the ones he should have been most intimate with, his wife and children. In this case, his one child, Archie, since Alan and Stephanie were no more than distant outsiders to him, a pair of children equivalent to the son and daughter of a third cousin, or the man who washed his car, which had made it easy for him to be kind and generous to them. But what about you, Archie? Ethel asked. And why did so much resentment build up between the two of you over the years? So much bitterness that Stanley refused to allow me to meet you and blocked you from our wedding, even though he kept on saying he had nothing against you and was, to use his words, content to wait it out. Ferguson wanted to explain it to her, but he knew how difficult it would be to delve into the 1,000 nuanced particulars of the long twilight struggle that had lasted the better part of his life. So he boiled it down to one simple and comprehensible statement. I was waiting for him to contact me. He was waiting for me to contact him. And before either one of us was willing to budge, time ran out. Two stubborn fools, Ethel said. That's it, two fools locked in their stubbornness. We can't change what happened, Archie. It's over and done with now, and all I can say is I hope you won't go on tormenting yourself about it any more than you already have. Your father was an odd man, but not a cruel or vindictive man, and even though he made things hard on you, I believe he was on your side. How can you know that? Because he didn't cut you out of his will. As far as I'm concerned, it should have been a much larger amount. But according to what your father told me, you have no interest in being the co-owner of a chain of 7 appliance stores. Is that right? None whatsoever. I'm still convinced he should have left you a lot more, but $100,000 isn't too bad, is it? Ferguson didn't know what to say, so he went on sitting in his chair and said nothing, answering Ethel's question by shaking his head, meaning no. $100,000 wasn't too bad, even though he wasn't sure at that point if he wanted to accept it or not. And now that there was nothing more to be said, Ethel and Ferguson went back upstairs, where he called his stepfather and told him he was ready to be picked up. When Dan's car appeared in front of the house 15 minutes later, Ferguson shook hands with Alan and Stephanie and said goodbye to them. And as Ethel walked him to the door, she told her dead husband's son that he should expect a call from Kaminsky the lawyer about his inheritance sometime within the next week or two. And then Ferguson and Ethel hugged each other goodbye, a hard, fervent embrace of solidarity and affection as they promised to stay in touch with each other from now on, even though they both knew they never would. In the car, Ferguson lit his 14th Camel of the day, cracked open the window, and turned to Dan. How was his mother doing? That was the first question he asked as they made their way to Woodhull Crescent, the peculiar but necessary question about his mother's state of mind after learning that her ex-husband and spouse for 18 years and the father of her son had abruptly and unexpectedly left this world. For in spite of their angry divorce and the uninterrupted silence that had existed between them since the divorce, it must have come as a jolt to her just the same. The word jolt says it all, Dan replied, which accounts for the tears, I think, and the astonishment and the sorrow. But that was 2 days ago, and by now she's more or less come to terms with it. You know how it is, Archie. Once a person dies, you start to feel different things about that person, no matter what trouble there might have been in the past. So you're saying she's all right? Don't worry. Before I left, she asked me to ask you if you knew anything about your father's will. Her brain is working again, which suggests the tears are finished. Momentarily turning his eyes from the road to look at Ferguson. She's a lot more concerned about you than she is about herself. As am I, for that matter. Rather than talk about the deadness and confusion in his own brain, Ferguson told Dan about the $100,000. He assumed the six-figure number would impress him, but the normally unriled and devil-may-care Dan Schneiderman was distinctly unimpressed. For a man of Stanley Ferguson's wealth, he said, $100,000 was the bare minimum, and anything lower than that would have been obnoxious. Still in all, Ferguson countered, it was a hell of a lot of money. Yes, Dan agreed, it was a veritable mountain. Ferguson then explained that he still hadn't decided what he wanted to do about it, whether to accept the money for himself or give it away. And while he was thinking it over, he wanted Dan and his mother to hold on to it for him. And if they should ever want to use some of it for themselves while he was still making up his mind, then they should feel free to do that, with his blessings. Don't be an ass, Dan said. The money's yours, Archie. Put it in your own account and spend it on yourself, any way you want. Your war with your father is over now, and you don't have to go on fighting it after he's dead. You could be right, but I have to make that decision myself, and I still haven't made it. In the meantime, the money goes to you and my mother for safekeeping. All right, give us the money, and when we get it, the first thing I'm going to do is write you a check for $5,000. Why $5,000? Because that's what you'll need to live on for the summer and your last year of college. It used to be $4,000, but now it's $5,000. You've heard of inflation, haven't you? Not only is the war killing people, it's also starting to kill the economy. But if I decide I don't want to keep the money, it won't be $100,000 anymore. It will be $95,000. Not after a year it won't. Interest is at 6% these days. By the time you graduate from college, the $95,000 will be $100,000 again. It's what we call invisible money. I never knew you were such a schemer. I'm not. You're the schemer, Archie. But unless I do a little scheming myself, I won't be able to keep up with you. The next big blow that spring was losing Celia. First cause. By the time Aunt Mildred pulled Ferguson out of the burning house and found him new shelter at Brooklyn College, it had been 1 year since he and Celia had put their arms around each other and ventured their first kiss. Love had followed from that kiss, a big love that now dwarfed all other loves from the past. But in that year, he had also learned how complicated loving Celia could be. When it was just the two of them alone together, Ferguson felt they were mostly in harmony, mostly able to overcome the differences that sometimes flared up between them by shedding their clothes and crawling into bed. And the bond of copious, lustful copulations kept them united even when they were at odds about how to live or what they imagined they were living for. Ferguson and Celia both had strong opinions on the matters that concerned them most. But those matters were often different matters in that Ferguson was preparing himself for a future in art and Celia was preparing herself for a future in science. And even though they both professed to admire what the other did, Ferguson had no doubt that Celia was enthusiastic about his work. Celia had no doubt that Ferguson was in awe of her immense academic brain. They couldn't be all things to each other all the time. Rebuttal. A gap between them, but not so broad a gap as to thwart their efforts to bridge it. Celia read books, listened to music, and merrily trotted off to movies and plays with Ferguson. And Ferguson himself was studying biology that year, needing one more science course to fulfill his requirement, but making that course biology because of her, in order to master the rudiments of the language she spoke, and, as he explained to Celia, to immerse himself more deeply in his book, which they both understood could be written only by penetrating the Noesian realm of physical bodies, the tissues and bones of the ill and healthy bodies his man had been treating for more than 20 years as a medical doctor. Beyond helping him with the work for his biology class, Celia also took it upon herself to arrange interviews with him with pre-med students from Barnard and Columbia, with young interns at St. Luke's, Lenox Hill, and Columbia Presbyterian, and an invaluable 4-hour meeting with her own family doctor since childhood, Gordon Edelman from New Rochelle, a compact, round-chested man who calmly walked Ferguson through the history and day-to-day routines of his practice, the dramas he had confronted over the years, and even talked for a while about Celia's brother's early death, explaining that Artie did not present symptoms of an aneurysm and consequently was not subjected to the dangerous procedure of an angiograph, which was the only method for examining a living brain in 1961, as opposed to the more reliable procedure of picking apart a dead brain during an autopsy. Did not present. In other words, there was nothing anyone could have done. And then the day arrived when the vessel broke, and the doctor's words were scrambled into three different words that carried an altogether different meaning. No longer present. Because of his novel, Ferguson was also making the bleak but necessary journey through the literature of suicide, and in order to keep pace with him, Celia read some of those books as well, beginning with philosophical, sociological, and psychological essays and studies by Hume, Schopenhauer, Durkheim, and Menninger, then numerous accounts from the distant past and near present, Empedocles and his mythic leap into the flames of Mount Etna, Socrates, Hemlock, Mark Antony, Sword, the mass suicide of Jewish rebels at Masada, Plutarch's description of Cato's self-murder in parallel lives, plucking out his own bowels in front of his son, his doctor, and his servants, the disgraced boy genius Thomas Chatterton, arsenic, the Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva, hanging, Hart Crane, jumping off a ship into the Gulf of Mexico, George Eastman, a gunshot to the heart, Hermann Goering, cyanide, and most pertinent of all, the opening sentences from The Myth of Sisyphus, quote, "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy." F. What do you think, Celia? Is Camus right or wrong? C. Probably right, but then again. F. I agree with you. Probably right, but not necessarily. Not all things all the time, but more than enough things to make a decent go of it, perhaps a splendid and lasting go. But they were still just 18 and 20. When the school year began, and one of the good things they shared was the double conviction that work came before pleasure, and that neither of them had any aptitude for domestic life. Even if Ferguson's apartment on East 89th Street had been big enough for two rather than one, they never would have considered living together, not because they were too young for the rigors of steady cohabitation, but because they were both essentially loners and needed long stretches of time alone in order to do their work. For Celia, that meant her studies at Barnard, where she was excelling not only in science and math, but in all her subjects, which put her firmly in the grind camp, an obsessive, round-the-clock grind who had joined up with four other Barnard grind girls for her sophomore year and was living in a large, gloomy dump on West 111th Street, an apartment she teasingly referred to as the cloister of perpetual stillness. For Ferguson, the exigencies of work were no less demanding, the taxing double job of trying to do his best at Brooklyn College while trying to write his novel, which was advancing slowly because of that. But one more good thing about the obsessive Celia was how deeply attuned she was to his obsessions, and several times that year, on the Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays, when they had made plans to see each other, and Ferguson found himself on a sudden roll with his book, she didn't take offense when he called her at the last minute to cancel the date, telling him to forge on and write his heart out and not to worry. That was the crux of it, he realized, the comrade spirit that set her apart from everyone else he had known. For there was never any doubt that she was disappointed by those last-minute calls, but had the guts, the strength of character, to pretend she wasn't. Second cause. A mostly harmonious meeting of minds and bodies when it was just the two of them alone together. But whenever they stepped out into the world and mixed with other people, life became problematic. Beyond the four girls she shared her apartment with, Celia had few close friends, perhaps no close friends. and therefore the bulk of their infrequent socializing consisted of floating in and out of Ferguson's world, which was mostly an alien world to Celia, a world she tried to understand but couldn't. She had no difficulties with the older generation and felt warmly treated by Ferguson's mother and stepfather. She enjoyed herself at the two dinners they had with Aunt Mildred and Uncle Don. But Noah and Howard both rubbed her the wrong way. Noah because she found his sarcastic, nonstop jesting unbearable, and Howard because she felt wounded by his polite indifference to her. She got along well enough with Amy and Jim's wife, Nancy, but the ever-expanding circle of Ferguson's poet and painter friends bored her and repelled her in equal measure. And it saddened Ferguson to see how unhappy she looked whenever they spent an evening with Billy and Joanna, who were as close to him as blood relations now. A sadness that turned into both guilt and irritation when he watched her sit through another one of his long, meandering talks about poets and writers with Ron, Lewis, or Anne, and even less did she comprehend why her noble, deep-thinking Archie found it so much fun to go to trashy Joan Crawford movies with Beau Janard and his friend Jack Ellerby, those slender fey boys who sometimes kissed each other in the darkness of the balcony and never stopped laughing. They all laughed too much, she said. Not one person in the crowd ever took anything seriously. They were sloppy, floppy, loosey-goosey starvelings with no aim in life except to prowl the margins of life and make art that no one wanted to see or buy. And yes, Ferguson admitted, perhaps that was true. But they were his boys and girls, his gallant, unembittered fellow outcasts. And because none of them was quite fit for this world, a burst of laughter now and then showed they were doing the best they could under the circumstances. Rebuttal. By the beginning of the new year, 1968, Ferguson understood that he could no longer subject Celia to his disreputable companions, some of whom were blatant homosexuals, some of whom were addicts and drunks, some of whom were emotionally disturbed cripples under psychiatric care, and even if some of them were contentedly married parents of young children. No matter how hard he tried to bring her into that small society of cracked-in-the-head monomaniacs, she would always resist it. And rather than go on punishing her for the sin of wanting to accompany him when he sought out the company of others, he would absolve her of the obligation to be with any others who were not to her liking. He knew it was a step in the wrong direction, that cutting her off from that part of his life would open a permanent space between them. But he didn't want to run the risk of losing Celia. And how else could he hold on to her except by liberating her from those unhappy evenings with his friends? The next time she slept over at his place, he picked up on something she said and then moved in on the subject as delicately as he could. They were lying in bed together, sharing one of his camels after a richly satisfying hour under and on top of the sheets and down comforter, talking about nothing of any importance, or perhaps not talking at all, he couldn't remember, perhaps just looking at each other, as they tended to do at such moments, each one filled up with the other and yet prolonging the moment by running their hands up and down and over the other's naked skin. No words other than Ferguson telling her how beautiful she was, if indeed he was saying that much. But he remembered that Celia's eyes were closed, and she was humming to herself, a soft little tuneless sound that resembled a purr. Languorous, long-limbed, panther woman Celia, lounging on her side and whispering to him in a throaty voice, "I love it when we're like this, Archie. Just the two of us on our island together, and the waves of the city splashing outside." "Me too," Ferguson said. "That's why I'm proposing a moratorium, a ban on any more contact with the outside." "Are you saying we should lock ourselves in this room and never go out?" "No, we can go out, but just the two of us, no more running around with other people." "That's fine with me. What do I care about other people?" "There's just one problem." A pause to puff and think about how to say it without upsetting her. "We'll have to start seeing each other a bit less often." "Why would we want to do that?" "Because the people you don't care about are not people I don't care about." "And which people are we referring to?" "The ones I forced down your throat. Billy Best, Howard Small, Noah Marks, Beau Janard, the whole lot of unacceptables." "I'm not against them, Archie." Maybe not, but you're not for them either. And I don't see why you should have to put up with them anymore. Are you saying this for me or for you? For both of us. It kills me to see you go into those funks of yours. I know you're trying to be nice, but you think I'm a twit, don't you? An uptight bourgeois noodlehead. That's right, a girl with straight A's and an invitation to go back to Woods Hole for the summer must be a twit and a noodlehead. But they're your friends. I don't want to let you down. They're my friends, but there's nothing that says they have to be your friends. It's kind of sad, don't you think? Not really. It's just a new arrangement, that's all. I'm talking about less, about seeing each other less often. If the quality of that less is more than the more we have now, then less will compensate for all the miserable hours I've spent watching you suffer with those people. And less will end up trumping more. Less, in fact, will be more. They settled into a new rhythm of weekends only. Two late afternoons, evenings, and nights per weekend. Either Friday and Saturday, Friday and Sunday, or Saturday and Sunday. Except on those rare Fridays, Saturdays, or Sundays when Ferguson called to cancel at the last minute, which left him free to associate with one or more of the unacceptables on the weekend night that was not shared with Celia, not to mention the weekday nights when he was not overburdened with schoolwork, the roughly one night in four when he had dinner with Billy and Joanna at their place down the street, talking about writers, politics, movies, painters, and sports as they took turns holding and playing with one-year-old Molly, big brother Billy Best, who had believed in Ferguson before anyone else and was his only prose writer friend in the fish tank of poets where he was swimming now. The only one with an ear for prose who could follow his arguments about why Flannery O'Connor and Grace Paley were bolder, more inventive stylists than Bellow, Updike, or any other American man except perhaps Baldwin. And in that way, Ferguson managed not to lose contact with the Bests or Noah or Howard or the Tumult Trio, or any of the other necessary ones who kept him anchored to the world. Yes, it was a little sad, as Celia had put it, but after a month and then another month of the new arrangement, he felt they were beginning to do better, breathing less fitfully because there were fewer distractions and exasperations to contend with. And yet Ferguson also knew there was much work still to be done, that the small problem he had solved was nothing compared to the big problem of hiding too much of himself from her. And unless he found the strength to open up to Celia and tell her everything she needed to be told about him, he would eventually destroy their future and end up with nothing. Third cause. It could be argued that the entire affair had been built on a false premise. It wasn't that Ferguson had lied to Celia, but he had persisted in withholding the truth from her about the primacy of Artie's death in the love equals divine justice formula. And even though he felt he had largely surmounted that problem with the game of catch in Riverside Park last spring, which had evolved into one-on-one games of wiffle ball with Celia throughout the summer, both in Woods Hole and on the farm in Vermont, especially during the grim weeks before his trial, when those festive laughing games had momentarily kept him from thinking about his day of reckoning in court, he still hadn't said a word to her about any of it. The mad 6-year-long fixation had come to an end, but if he was cured now, or even just partially restored to health, why hadn't he summoned the courage to tell Celia about the abnegations he had imposed on himself as a tribute to his dead AF twin? Because he was scared. Because he feared she would judge him insane and want nothing to do with him anymore. Even worse, there was his inability to tell her about his condition, to reveal the secret of his abnormal birth as the progeny of a male donkey and a female horse, the braying Jack who had mounted the comely mare in a New Jersey barn one night in the summer of 1946 and had impregnated her with a mule. Ferguson, the talking mule, who was a creature who could sire no offspring and therefore fell into the category of genetic dud. And so crushing was that truth to Ferguson, so damaging to the phallic certainties of his male self, he could never bring himself to share it with Celia, which meant that he allowed her to go through the needless exercise of taking birth control precautions every time they went to bed together, never once telling her there was no point in inserting her diaphragm because making love with him guaranteed that she would never have to worry about becoming pregnant. An inexcusable error. Cowardice on such a grand scale that it turned him into the one thing he had vowed never to become. Dishonorable. Rebuttal. There was no rebuttal. In Ferguson's mind, however, the possibility that Dr. Broiler's diagnosis had been wrong continued to give him hope. Until and unless he consulted another doctor, the inexcusable would remain excusable because there was always a small chance that birth control was necessary, and he didn't want Celia to know the shameful truth of his condition until he was 100% certain of it. All he had to do was go to another doctor and have himself tested again. But he was too afraid to go, too afraid to find out, and he kept putting it off. Conclusion. 2.5 weeks after his father's death, when the fire of the moment spread its flames to the Columbia campus, Celia put on a green armband and helped the cause by making sandwiches for the students inside the buildings, one of several dozen volunteers in the Ferris Booth Hall Chow Brigade. Not the red armband of the activists, but the green band of sympathizers and supporters, a reasonable position for someone who took no part in campus politics and devoted all her energies to studying for her classes. But Celia had political opinions, and even if she wasn't cut out for the frontline actions of manning barricades and occupying university buildings, those opinions were strong enough to put her on the side of the students against the administration. No matter what qualms she might have had about the students' tactic, and no matter how often she cringed when she heard 100 or 500 voices shouting, "Up against the wall, motherfucker." As Ferguson saw it, Celia was acting in accord with the fundamental principles of the Fetterman Bill of Rights, the same impulse that had prompted her to put down the dollar in front of the old man at the automat when she was 16. And now that she was 19, nothing had changed. She called him at his apartment on the night of the 23rd, and as Ferguson listened to her describe what had happened at Columbia that day, the noon rally at the sundial in the middle of the campus, the attack on the gym construction site in Morningside Park, and then the takeover of Hamilton Hall by a coalition of SDS and SAS, white students and black students working in concert to shut down the university, he started to laugh, partly out of surprise, he imagined, but mostly out of happiness. When he hung up the phone, he understood that it was the first good laugh he had produced since before the evening he had picked up the same phone and talked to Alan Blumenthal. At 1 o'clock on Friday afternoon, the 26th, he decided to suspend work on his novel for the rest of the day and head crosstown to check out what was happening at Columbia. It was too late to call Celia, who was undoubtedly with her fellow sandwich makers in the chow room at Ferris Booth Hall, but it wasn't going to be difficult to find her. And once he managed to tear her away from her platters of ham, bologna, and pre-cut slices of packaged bread, they could walk around the campus together and see what was going on. As the crosstown bus traveled up Madison Avenue, he fell into the same conversation he seemed to have with himself every time he went to Morningside Heights. What if he had gone to Columbia instead of Princeton? And if he had gone there, how would his life have been different from the one he was leading now? No Brooklyn College for one thing, no East 89th Street for another, no walking in on his grandfather's porn movie for yet another, no $10,000, no Nagel, and no Howard Small, which would have meant no barroom fight in Vermont, no trial, no miraculous rescue by Aunt Mildred, no imaginary tennis matches, and no romance between Howard and Amy, which had turned into a hot romance that showed no signs of cooling off anytime soon. The same three books with Gizmo, however, although the second and third would have been slightly different books, and the same roles for Mary Donahue, Evie Monroe, and Celia. But if he had gone to Columbia, would he be sitting in one of the occupied buildings with the protesting students now, or would his life have put him on this same crosstown bus that was traveling along the northern edge of Central Park on its way to Morningside Heights? The situation had altered since the 23rd. The black-white alliance had broken apart, but four more buildings had been taken over by students, and the chairman of SDS, the acknowledged leader of the rebellion, happened to be one of Ferguson's old friends from high school, Mark Rudd. Yes, Mike Loeb was part of it too, Amy's ex-tormentor, ergo Ferguson's ex-friend. But according to what Celia had heard, Loeb was just another one of the SDSers taking part in meetings at Mathematics Hall, whereas Rudd was in charge, the SDS spokesman and instigator-in-chief. And he and Ferguson had always gotten along well, sitting in many of the same English, French, and history classes together, going out on double dates with their almost identically named girlfriends, Dana and Diana, and cutting school together one morning to run off to New York, where they visited the stock exchange on Wall Street in order to see capitalism in action. And how fitting and oddly funny it was that Mark, who had taught him how to drive a standard shift car in the spring of their junior year, which had allowed Ferguson to operate Arnie Fraser's Chevy van, and spent another summer as a mover of large, heavy objects, was now leading a student rebellion and had his picture in the paper every day. As it happened, Ferguson didn't quite make it to Columbia that afternoon. The number 4 crosstown bus traveled from the east side to the west side along 110th Street, alternatively known as Cathedral Parkway, in the blocks between Central Park West and Riverside Drive. And when the bus reached the corner of Broadway and 110th, Ferguson jumped off and began walking north toward the campus on 116th Street. But in order to get to where he was going, he first had to go by the block where Celia lived, West 111th between Broadway and Amsterdam. And curiously enough, as he passed 111th and plodded on toward the next corner, he unexpectedly caught sight of Celia herself. Celia in a flowing blue skirt and pink blouse, about half a block ahead of him and also walking north, no doubt on her way to the chow room at Ferris Booth Hall. The fact that Celia wasn't alone did not disturb him, even though the person she was with was not one of her Barnard roommates but a man, in this case a 22-year-old man named Richard Smolin, whom Ferguson recognized as one of the Columbia pre-med students he had talked to back in October when Celia had been setting up interviews for him as an aide to writing his novel. And because Smolin was from New Rochelle and had played on baseball and basketball teams with Artie as a boy, Celia had known him all her life. And why would Ferguson feel the slightest envy or apprehension to discover that Celia was walking uptown with an old friend? He quickened his pace in order to catch up with them. But before he could get within shouting distance, Celia and Richard Smolin stopped in the middle of the sidewalk, threw their arms around each other, and began to kiss. It was a passionate kiss, a prolonged kiss, a lustful kiss of pure and uncontrollable desire. And from all Ferguson could gather as he stood on the sidewalk not 20 feet from where they were embracing, it was a kiss of love. If it was love, one could only assume they had just emerged from Celia's apartment, where they had spent the past however many hours rolling around on Celia's bed. And now that they had put their clothes back on and were walking north to Columbia to make sandwiches for the students in the occupied buildings, the afterglow of their lust binge was burning so brightly that they couldn't keep their hands off each other and were still hungry for more. Ferguson turned around and began walking south. Epilogue. He didn't call, and she didn't call until Monday, to tell him about Smolin, which was old news to him by then, and to call it quits. A silent weekend during which he concluded that he was to blame for the disaster and that Smolin wasn't the cause of his trouble so much as a symptom of them. And because he had been dishonest with her from the start, he deserved to be dumped. Celia the beautiful. Celia and the manifold deliriums of touching Celia and folding her body into his. But sex wasn't enough. It seemed unimaginable to have arrived at that thought, but sex wasn't enough, and nearly everything else about them had been wrong. He had willed himself to love her, but he had never loved anything but the idea of loving her, which wasn't love, but a form of gross and unforgivable stupidity. So let her go off with her handsome pre-med boy, he said to himself. Let her walk with her future heart specialist and current heartthrob back into the whirlwind at Columbia. for the fire was still spreading, and the time had come for Ferguson to let her whirl out of his life and go to the next place without him. In the months that followed, no more central characters in the Ferguson story dropped dead on tennis courts or anywhere else, and no more loves were found or lost or even contemplated. A slow, dreary summer with his novel, as he began writing the second of the two parts, locked up in his studio apartment for most of the day, with no one to see at night except for Billy and Joanna down the block and Noah, who was in town working as an actor in his first professional film. But Noah was both busy and exhausted and had little time for him except on the weekends. Everyone else was gone, either camped out in family bungalows or rented shacks in upstate New York and New England, or following the low-budget trail through various cities and countrysides in Western Europe. As always, Howard was at his aunt and uncle's farm in Vermont, but this time Amy was with him, and the two of them were already discussing plans for life after college, which would begin in just 1 year. And assuming Howard managed to avoid the draft, they were both thinking about graduate school, Howard in philosophy and Amy in American history, the ideal choice being Columbia, where they could live together in an apartment on Morningside Heights and become citizens of New York. Again and again, Howard and Amy asked Ferguson to visit them in Vermont, and again, Ferguson invented an excuse not to make the trip. Vermont was a haunted place for him, he said, and he still didn't know if he was quite ready to go back there. Or he was too wrapped up in his novel to think of leaving New York. Or he had come down with a summer cold and wasn't up to traveling. But even as he said those things, which were partly true, the greater truth was that now that he had lost Celia, Amy was in his thoughts again. The eternally lost and beloved Amy, who had never wanted him and never would. And to expose himself to the spectacle of her happiness with his unofficial brother-in-law was more than he could have handled just then. It wasn't that he had stopped thinking about Celia that summer, but she climbed into his head less often than he had imagined she would. And as the first hot month turned into the second hot month, he was beginning to feel almost glad they were no longer together, as if a spell had been broken. And he was back to being himself, and not some fabricated or deluded vision of himself. Whereas Artie was with him again in the summer heat. Artie's death and his father's death. Those were the memories he dwelled on most as he sat in his hot little room, bleeding out the words of his book. And once the matter of his inheritance had been settled at the end of April, not a standard bequest, as it turned out, but the funds from a life insurance policy that circumvented the need to pay any death taxes. He had taken the $5,000 from Dan, and now watched in morbid wonder as month by month the $95,000 inched its way back to the original $100,000. Invisible money, Dan had said. Ferguson called it ghost money. He was writing a book about death. And on some days he felt the book was trying to kill him. Every sentence was a struggle. Every word in every sentence could have been a different word. And as with all the other things he had written in the past 3 years, he was turning out roughly 4 pages for every page he kept. Still in all, he had 122 finished pages by the beginning of the summer, and half the story had been told. A plague of suicides that is now coming to the end of its third month, during which the city of R has buried 21 of its children, an alarming number for a provincial town of 94,000 inhabitants, and Dr. Noyes has been in the thick of it from the start, working with 24 fellow doctors, 12 psychiatrists, and close to 30 priests and ministers to ward off the next suicide. But in spite of their intense collective effort, which entails long interviews and counseling sessions with every young person in the city, nothing they do provides the smallest bit of help. And by now, the doctor is questioning whether the countless hours they are putting in to end the scourge have only prolonged it, whether isolating a problem and holding it up to public view, month after month after month, doesn't keep the problem alive rather than solve it, thereby tempting the vulnerable ones to solve their own problems in ways they might not have thought of on their own. And so the children of R go on killing themselves as before. And bit by bit, the staunch Dr. Noyes is coming undone. That was where Ferguson had left off when he took his final exams and wrote his end-of-the-term course papers in June. And as he felt his way back into the story during the early weeks of the summer, he already knew how it was going to end. But helpful as it was to know that, knowing was not doing, and getting to the end would mean little unless he managed to do it right. The problem facing the young people of Noyes City are at once eternal and of the moment, a combination of biological destiny and contingent historical facts, the adolescent upheavals of first loves and broken loves, the daily fear of being singled out for expulsion by the herd, the fear of pregnancy, the trauma of real pregnancy and too early motherhood, the thrills of excess, driving too fast, drinking too much, ennui, contempt for parents, adults, and everyone in charge, melancholy, loneliness, and the pain of the world, Weltschmerz, pressing on the heart, even as sunlight pours down upon them. The old, never-ending torments of being young. But for the ones most at risk, the 17 and 18-year-old boys, there is the threat of Vietnam looming before them the instant they leave school, the incontestable reality of the American moment. For few high school graduates go on to college from the blue-collar city of R, where the end of high school means the beginning of adult life. And now that 64 coffins containing the bodies of dead U.S. soldiers have been shipped back home and buried in local cemeteries over the past 3 years, now that the limbless and eyeless older brothers of those boys have landed in the wards of the nearby VA hospital in W, the patriotic fervor that swept through R in the summer of 1965 has turned to revulsion and dread by the spring of 1968. And the war being fought by the American government on the other side of the world is no longer a war any of those boys is willing to fight in. To die for nothing as their brothers did, as their cousins did, as their friends' brothers did, seems to mock the principles of life itself. And why were they born, they asked themselves, and what are they doing on this earth if it is only to give away their lives for nothing before they have even begun to live? Some maim themselves by shooting off fingers and toes in order to flunk their army physicals, but others prefer the less bloody solution of gassing themselves to death in idling cars enclosed within their parents' locked garages. And as often as not, if the boy happens to have a girlfriend, the girl and the boy will be sitting in the car together, wrapped in each other's arms as the fumes slowly carry out their work. In the beginning, Noyes is appalled by these senseless deaths and does everything he can to stop them. But as time goes on, his thoughts start moving in a different direction. And by the fourth or fifth month, he is infected by the contagion himself. What Ferguson was proposing to do with the story after that was to follow Noyes through the various steps that will lead him to take his own life at the end of the book. The enormous sympathy he develops for the young people in his charge, the conversations with more than 250 boys and girls that convince him the city is not going through a medical crisis, but a spiritual crisis, that the question is not death or a desire for death, but a loss of hope in the future. And once Noyes understands that they are all living in a world without hope, Ferguson was planning to put him together with one of the young people he has been counseling for the past months, a 17-year-old girl named Lily McNamara, whose twin brother Harold has already killed himself, and the no longer married and childless Dr. Noyes will take Lily into his house for a week or a month or half a year and try to talk the plain, stubborn, inarticulate girl into giving up her thoughts of death. It will be his last stand, a last effort to push back his own desire to succumb. And when he fails to turn her back to life, he will follow her into the garage, shut the doors and windows, and then climb into the car with her and turn on the ignition. 74 slowly written and rewritten pages between mid-June and mid-September. And 2 weeks after he started riding the subway back and forth to Brooklyn again, his collected works were published by Tumult Books. After such a hard summer, Prolusion sprang up out of the earth as unexpectedly as the first crocus in early spring, a flash of purple bursting through the mud and blackened snow on the chilly ground. a beautiful spear of color in an otherwise colorless world. For the dust jacket of Prelusions was indeed purple, the shade of purple called mauve, the color Ferguson and Ron had selected out of the numerous colors available to them, an austerely designed typographical cover, with his name and the title in black bordered by a thin white rectangle, a glancing nod to the Gallimard covers in France. Elegant, so very elegant, Ferguson thought, and when he held a copy of the book in his hands for the first time, he experienced something he had not been prepared for. A thunderbolt of exaltation. Not dissimilar to the exaltation he had felt after winning the Walt Whitman scholarship, he realized, but with this difference. The scholarship had been taken away from him, but the book would always be his, even if no more than 17 people ever read it. There were reviews. For the first time in his life, he was bussed and slapped in public. 13 times over the next 4 months by his reckoning. Long, medium, and short reviews in newspapers, magazines, and literary quarterlies. 5 satisfying tongue kisses, a friendly pat on the back, 3 punches to the face, 1 knee to the balls, 1 execution by firing squad, and 2 shrugs. Ferguson was both a genius and an idiot, both a wonder boy and a supercilious oaf, both the best thing that had happened this year and the worst thing that had happened this year, both brimming with talent and utterly devoid of it. Nothing had changed since the Hank Frank rumpus with Mrs. Baldwin and the contravening opinions of Aunt Mildred and Uncle Don half a century ago. The push and pull of positive and negative, the endless standoff in the courtrooms of judgment. But try as he did to ignore both the good and the bad that were said about him, Ferguson had to admit that the stings went on stinging long after the kisses had worn off, that it was harder to forget being attacked as a, quote, frantic, out-of-control hippie who doesn't believe in literature and wants to destroy it, than it was to remember being praised as, quote, a bright new kid on the block. Fuck it, he said to himself, as he filed away the reviews in the bottom drawer of his desk. If and when he ever published another book, he would stop up his ears with candle wax, cover his eyes with a blindfold, strap his body to the mast of a ship, and then ride out the storm until the sirens could no longer touch him. Not long after the book came out, Mary Donahue came back in. Celia had been gone for 5 months at that point, and the solitary, sex-starved Ferguson was more than interested to hear from Joanna that her sister had recently broken up with her boyfriend of the past 18 months. And if Ferguson had any wish to see Mary again, Joanna would be more than happy to invite them both to dinner one night in the coming days or weeks. Mary was all done with Michigan now and was back in New York studying law at NYU, 15 or 20 pounds slimmer, according to Joanna. And she was asking him because Mary had asked her, and if Ferguson was willing, it appeared Mary would be willing too. And so it was that Ferguson and Mary started seeing each other again, that is, started sleeping together again, as in the old days back in the summer of 1966. And no, it wasn't love, it would never be love, but in some ways it was even better than love. Friendship, friendship pure and simple, with immense quantities of admiration on both sides. And so deeply had Ferguson come to trust Mary by the second month of their second affair that she was the one he chose to unburden himself to about Celia, opening up for the first time about the arty business, the baseball business, and the shameful diaphragm business, telling her what he had never been able to tell anyone else. And when he had marched to the end of that wretched tale of silence and deceit, he turned away from her, looked at the wall and said, "What's wrong with me?" "Being young," Mary replied, "that's the only thing that was ever wrong with you. You were young and you thought the thoughts of an undeveloped young person with a big heart and an overdeveloped case of youthful idealism. Now you're not so young anymore and you've stopped thinking that way." "Is that all?" "That's all, except for the other thing, which has nothing to do with being young. You should have told her, Archie. What you did was... how could I say this without hurting your feelings? Reprehensible. Yes, that's the word for it, reprehensible. I wanted to marry her, you see, or at least I thought I wanted to marry her. And if I told her we would never be able to have children, she probably would have turned me down. Still, it was wrong not to say anything about it. Well, I've told you, haven't I? It's not the same with me. Oh, and why is that? Because you don't want to marry me. Who knows if I do or don't? Who knows if you do or don't? Who knows anything? Mary laughed. At least you can stop taking the pill now, Ferguson continued. You're not the only man in New York, you know. What happens if I stumble out one night, bump into Señor Magnifico, and get swept off my feet? Just don't tell me about it, that's all I ask. In the meantime, Archie, you should go to another doctor, just to make sure. I know, Ferguson said, I know I should, and I will, someday soon. Of course I'll go, someday soon, I promise. 1969 was the year of the seven conundrums, the eight bombs, the 14 refusals, the two broken bones, the number 263, and the one life-changing joke. 1. 4 days after Richard Nixon was installed as the 37th President of the United States, Ferguson wrote the last sentence of The Capital of Ruins. The first draft was done. The long-labored-over first draft, which had been through so many revisions by then that it probably could have counted as the 9th or 10th draft. But Ferguson still wasn't satisfied with the manuscript, not fully satisfied at any rate, feeling there was more work to be done before he could declare it finished. So he held on to the book for another 4 months, tinkering and refining, cutting and adding, replacing words and sharpening sentences. And when he sat down to type up the final version in early June, he was in the middle of his final exams at Brooklyn College and almost ready to graduate.